Texas and Oklahoma just had their hottest months on record. Parts of Texas have seen 38 consecutive days of over 100-degree heat, only 6 inches of rain in the last 8 months, a drought that's killing fish, animals, plants, insects, which of course means less pollination and fewer plants and the animals that eat them in the near future. Even migratory birds are expected to suffer in Texas's drought since they won't be making a stop in that parched state on their way to Central America. And of course, in Somalia, people are dying from drought and warfare. 29,000 children in the last 3 months. Alex Prudhomme recently wrote an article for the New York Times entitled Drought, a Creeping Disaster. He reminds us that last year, more people, 138, were killed by the heat than by hurricanes, tornadoes, and floods combined. He speaks with climatologists like Richard Seeger at the Lamont Dougherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University, who compare drought to a python squeezing us to death. Alex has also written the book The Ripple Effect about the looming water crisis in America, and he joins us for more on that from the NPR studios in New York. Alex, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And you ask an academic right at the beginning of your article in the Times whether this idea of a perpetual drought is possible. He had an interesting answer.
Yes, I spoke to Dr. Richard Seeger, and he said in the Southwest in particular, we're facing a potential permanent drying out. And this is something he thinks that we ought to start preparing for right now.
And by permanent drying out, he meant desert. He said, you don't say the Sahara Desert is a drought. You say it's a desert.
Exactly. Drought implies a temporary drying out. What he's saying is that thanks to climate change and water use patterns and demographic shifts and indeed, human interference with the climate, that we are facing a more permanent aridification.
This is something American climatologists are talking about. Tell us more about the meaning of that word.
Well, as Seeger explains it, it's a permanent drying. The land and the air are becoming more arid. And this has a whole series of ripple effects, if you will. Not only does that lessen the ability of crops to grow, which will impact us, but also impact cattle, it leads to greater dust storms, which leads to things that you don't think of, like the buildup of salts and chemicals on electrical wires, which then leads to blackouts. It leads to farmers having to use their water pumps more, which then can become very expensive and add to climate change when you think about the emissions. One of the points of my piece in the New York Times was to say, we'd better start thinking about it now because the terrible droughts that we've seen across the South and Southwest this year are really an indication of things to come.
And some cities in other countries are. You cite Perth, Australia, where the population has surpassed 1.7 million, while the precipitation has decreased.
Well, that's a particularly interesting case. They're concerned that here we have Perth, a major metropolitan area with a growing population and decreasing precipitation. And they're very worried that at one point it could reach a tipping point and actually become the first ghost city in the world, a place that can't sustain its population because of lack of water. And there will have to be a depopulating of a city like Perth.
Well, you know, and that starts to feel like a horror movie because, you know, humankind always manages to do something like build a dam or a pipeline or an aqueduct. And, you know, tell us the problem with that thinking.
Well, over the last couple hundred years, America has been very good at using giant pieces of hydro infrastructure, such as dams and levees and aqueducts, to trap and collect and transport water great distances. You know, in the old days, it used to be that we had to build our communities around water sources for obvious reasons. But now we've gotten so good at collecting water that we've decided we can build wherever we like, and we bring the water to us. Those big pieces of infrastructure tend to be very expensive to build. They require constant maintenance. They have tremendous impact on the environment. They silt up quickly. They change water flows.
As we just witnessed with the Mississippi flooding recently and levees failing and people pointing fingers at past work that had been done to redirect this river and the river now saying no. And you write that there's some new thinking of flipping the Mississippi to redirect Mississippi floodwaters to the west?
Right. Well, if you look at what's happened this year, there's some pretty remarkable headlines. In the Midwest and Mountain West, you have record-breaking floods. In the South and Southwest, you have record-breaking drought. And people look at this and say, well, why can't we take the excess floodwaters and pipe them down to the south and southwest. And one of these schemes, is, as you say, is called flipping the Mississippi, which is to take the excess runoff from a flood along the Mississippi and pipe it west, which will relieve pressure on the Colorado River, which now supplies seven states, Indian tribes, and Mexico. Perhaps you use that water to refill the Ogallala Aquifer, which is being depleted rapidly. You know, these are very pie-in-the-sky ideas. They're conceptually interesting, and they're actually probably possible from an engineering standpoint. I mean, you figure we bring oil from Alaska down to Texas, for example, but there are many problems inherent in such a big project. Again, it's very expensive. There'll be tremendous environmental impacts. You know, actually, the water in the Mississippi and the flora and fauna are different than the water in many western rivers. And I've been told that if you put Mississippi water in, like, the Rio Grande, for example, could actually do a lot of harm. So these things aren't so simple.
You've just got these unintended consequences. But as far as creating water, as far as creating rain, you talk about weather modification, you know, cloud seeding. I did not know that Vail, Colorado, hires companies to seed snow-producing clouds. You say that will never bring the major supply of water that's needed. So what is working?
We do have in hand some very basic technologies that seem to work quite well. Low-flush toilets, low-flow showerheads, drip irrigation, side-mounted washer-dryer machines. These things are not very sexy, but they save tremendous amounts of water.
You also write about using smart meters to find out how much water you use, and maybe when you see it, that might affect behavior, but also identify leaks. Leaks drain off more than a trillion gallons of water a year.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
That's amazing.
It's true. It's shocking. When you see a little tiny leak in your sink or something, you don't think it's going to really add up. But, you know, it's not just your leak. It's everybody else's leaks or the pipes that are leaking into the ground that you don't see. This is water that's been carefully and somewhat expensively captured, treated, piped, and then to have it just waste away like that just is crazy.
Alex, we want to talk about solutions. We recently spoke with the author of another book. He talked about recycling sewage and things like desalination using seawater to drink. Your thoughts?
Well, the holy grail of water managers is to find what's called a drought-proof source. And for centuries, man has dreamed of taking ocean water and turning it into drinking water. The problem with that is that it's very effective, but it comes at a cost. It's expensive because you have to use tremendous amounts of power to suck those pollutants out of the water. The water intake for these plants often kills young fish and eggs and so on. And then when you extract the salts, you produce a very concentrated brine. And the question is, what do you do with that? Because it's so concentrated that when you push it back out into the ocean, it tends to kill things off or harm things. So that's been quite controversial. There's a big plant being built in Carlsbad, California now that's been held up for a decade by legal challenges and now by financial challenges. I think it's inevitable that we'll start using desal a bit more. But again, I don't think it's a silver bullet that's going to solve all of our problems. When you get to the question of sewage recycling, the process is interesting because that's a kind of a holistic system. Sewage is produced, but something like 90% of that is actually water. And we, using the same reverse osmosis technology as desal, we have been able to extract the pollutants out of that water and again produce ultra pure water. And in Orange County, California, where there's a large new plant, what they do is they take this ultra pure water and they put it back into the natural aquifers. And eventually it works its way through a whole system of aquifers and emerges in the taps of over 20 million people in Orange County. As the water managers there told me, look, we're not doing this by choice. We're doing this because we have to.
You say Americans should look to Singapore for a good model because not only do they use water from desalination and recycling of wastewater, but they use a lot of rainwater collection. And they have high water taxes.
Well, Singapore is obviously a very different case than the U.S. It's a small, autocratic island nation. But they do provide a very useful model for the efficient use of fresh water. And so starting in the 60s, they began to develop a very sophisticated program. Now they get about 40% of their water from Malaysia and another 25 to 30% from desal and from recycling sewage. And then the rest is drawn from rainwater collection and wells and so on. They curb their demand by instituting high water taxes. They insist on efficient water technologies. And they are constantly educated by the government to conserve and to be efficient in their water use. Maybe even more important than that, that the water program in Singapore is overseen by a very sophisticated, politically autonomous, well-financed water authority. And they've been able to bring water use down per capita about 10 liters a day over the last decade. We could learn some lessons. I mean, I think that in America, people really don't pay attention to their water, and we ought to start paying attention. And the best way to do that is to start educating ourselves and educating each other, and maybe some of that needs to come from the top. We don't price water very well here. It's often free or close to free. 70% of our water is used by agriculture, often in a not a very efficient way. And we ought to start promoting some of these basic technologies like harvesting rainwater, recycling sewage, using drip irrigation, storing water underground so it doesn't evaporate so quickly. And I would just to finish up, I think what's really important is that we ought to start to institute a national water policy. You know, Western water law and Eastern water law in the U.S. are completely different. And I argue in my book that we ought to at least start having the conversation about having a federal water body of some kind, perhaps even a water czar, to manage the nation's supply in a holistic way.
Or what, Alex Prudhomme? Because we haven't even mentioned that the global demand for water is expected to increase by two-thirds by 2025. And, you know, we've heard on this program people say that countries are going to go to war over water.
That's certainly possible. Water is the defining resource of this century. It will become at least as important, if not more important, than oil. If you look at the conflict in Darfur, for example, that is not a pure water war. It's a kind of a complicated situation between tribes and religions and so on. But water was the precipitating factor there. I mean, you look at the Koreas. They've fought over water. You look at Pakistan, India. You look at Israel and its neighbors. These are all regions that have had traditional tensions over water. But now with more people, with changing climates, with changing demographics and diets and the way we use and pollute water, those tensions are going to be exacerbated in coming decades.
But there are people who say that this is just a climate pattern and that yours is a, you know, is that Chicken Little point of view. How do you respond to that?
I say, look at the data. Talk to the experts like Richard Seeger. These guys are running computer models based on historical trends. This is what they spend all day, every day doing. And it's foolish to stick your head in the sand, as it were, and not pay attention to it. When we know that this is a threat, why not try to take some proactive action rather than waiting for a crisis? Because water, unlike oil or natural gas or gold or diamonds or anything else, is an essential resource. We need it to survive, and that's what makes it different. If you look at places like Las Vegas or Phoenix or Dallas or even L.A., these are desert cities that are booming. You have to wonder about the long-term wisdom of that. You know, you can deny it, but let's talk in 2 decades from now and see what you're saying.
That soon.
Yeah, well, maybe, yeah. Yeah.
That's Alex Prudhomme. His article in the New York Times is Drought, a Creeping Disaster. His book, The Ripple Effect, also looks at the looming water shortage in the U.S. Alex, thanks so much for speaking to us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Robin.